So welcome to the recording. Extremely excited to be here with our friend Jon Kabat-Zinn and talking about, I guess in some ways it's mindfulness in the digital age, and my personal interest that we've talked about before is, you know, how does mindfulness, you know, relate to the real world? And one thing that Jon and I have in common is coming from the five boroughs of New York. So to me, I was always, you know, I've been into this wellness stuff forever, but I've always wondered, you know, well, how do the guys on the street back in Brooklyn, you know, what is relevant to them in the real world, in their life? And I was having dinner, one of my friends finally got out, he's moving to California, so we had a dinner a couple of months ago, and he came up with the phrase. We were talking about, you know, how are you going to be? He's on his own. How are you going to be in San Diego by yourself? And he says, I'm street smart. I got it covered. So it started thinking, well, what is street smart wisdom? You know, and then we're doing wisdom feed. So this is a whole new kind of invention we're creating. And I think there's a lot of things out there already about mindfulness, wellness, that for people already into it, or for people already at the ashram, or they've done MBSR, and this content ideally is for those people, but it's also a way to kind of boil it down to street level, or down to that everyday wisdom kind of thing.
Well, I'm totally in accord with you, and you know, really feel that with mindfulness moving more and more into the mainstream, so to speak, it's like, well, what is the mainstream? Is it just the privileged? Is it just the kind of people who, you know, have other resources so they can afford to worry about stress and their stress reduction? And the answer is no, absolutely not. From the very beginning of my work, don't forget, it started in Worcester, Massachusetts, you know, the second biggest city in New England that nobody's heard of. and it was always a kind of really working class city that in the late 70s, when I started doing this kind of work there, it felt like the 50s, like it was back in time, so to speak, much like the era in which you and I grew up in New York City. And with what I would call just like real people, you know, working class people who, you know, and with, in some sense, segregated neighborhoods. So there were, you know, African-American neighborhoods, and there were Hispanic neighborhoods, and there were white neighborhoods, and they really didn't speak to each other all that much in the old days. There was quite a bit of kind of sequestering in different neighborhoods, but everybody was coming to the stress reduction clinic, you know, because it was, we didn't make those kinds of distinctions. As if your doctor suggested that you know, need this kind of mindfulness training to deal with your stress or chronic pain or illness, then we would take you. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of education you've had, how much education you've had, what your, you know, country of origin is, or anything like that. We would just take all comers, and certainly not whether you were a Democrat or a Republican. We were just like, if you're a human being, we'll take you. And, you know, we did set up an inner city clinic because there was a sense that people from the inner city were not actually coming to the flagship University of Massachusetts Medical Center because it was somewhat removed from their neighborhood. So we actually went into an inner city hospital, and for 4 or 5 years, we delivered mindfulness-based stress reduction right there in concert with an inner city clinic that made referrals, where pretty much the whole population was African American, Hispanic, and Caucasian, but people who were really economically very much on the lower end of things. And one of the reasons we did that was to demonstrate that, in fact, mindfulness training is universal and it is universally valuable. So you can get the same kind of effects on the body and the mind and stress reduction and so forth by training people anywhere as you can get in the flagship, you know, more sort of white privileged middle class population for, of the UMass Medical Center. So that is work dating back to the, you know, early 90s. Once we demonstrated that mindfulness was in fact something that Americans would take to, because who knew that Americans would meditate at all, you know, in the mainstream, not just kind of the, you know, hippie lunatic fringe, so to speak, the way it might have been described in those days. And also not just for college students or for college educated people or more educated people. And I love that. I mean, I think there's something so wonderful about the notion, which I feel very strongly, that education and growth and development is something that's, you know, a lifetime's engagement. And so it's not about, like, you go to school, you learn stuff, and then the rest of your life, you don't ever learn anything. I mean, people, we're always constantly learning. But in this society, a lot of what we're learning is how to get somewhere else. And if we're busy always trying to get somewhere else, the unfortunate downside of that is that we're never where we actually are. And there's a certain tragedy to that. There's a huge sadness to that, because if we're always trying to get to some better moment, some happy place or some happy time or some happy hour where it's all gonna get taken care of, especially if we, you know, sort of catalyze it or, you know, sort of grease the wheels with some alcohol or some, you know, sort of drugs or whatever it is to make ourselves feel better in some moments because we're actually in so much pain. That is not a prescription for a long, happy, healthy life. And so our work has demonstrated that we can take just virtually anybody who is motivated to, because they're suffering so much, to actually face the suffering and help them actually realize, wake up to the fact that we are only alive in this present moment. And when we learn how to drop into being, then whatever we need to do in terms of doing and getting things done or getting a job or finding a new way to be in relationship to one's own challenges or stress, that those things come out of the quality of your presence of mind in being and whether you're willing to inhabit your body. So these things that maybe 40 years ago were seen as like the airy-fairy lunatic fringe, that who's into yoga, who's into meditation, it's only like, you know, sort of these kind of people on the fringe, that this has actually been demonstrated, and the science certainly supports it, to be almost axiomatically essential for dealing with the increasing complexity of the world, where, you know, the world in 1979, when I started the stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, that was before anybody had digital anything. And now we're in this digital era where, you know, digital natives, in other words, the people who were never born into the analog world, don't even know what an old telephone would look like, what a landline is. They're living in an alternate universe from what we grew up in. And there's a certain challenge here that we're facing, I think, as human beings, as a species, and that is how to not lose our analog essential nature as we get so caught up in the technology that we're potentially victims of our own hunger for distraction, for information, for constantly feeding this attention-grabbing, eyeball-grabbing beast that actually has deep effects on our brain, deep effects on our sense of connectedness, and they can be very powerfully positive, or they can be basically alienating and isolating, as per the work of Sherry Turkle at MIT, who's showing how, you know, isolating it can be to always be clutching your phone, and it changes your relationship with the people even that you're having dinner with, because everybody's got their phone on the table at dinner if you're under a certain age. And then
right, I'm guilty. I heard her speak at the Wisdom 2.0 conference, so I have my phone sitting here. One of the stats that she said that I think was fascinating, that even if you turn your phone face down, yeah, the quality of conversation is improved.
Yeah.
I'm at least going to turn my phone face down then.
Yeah. Well, you've shut it off already anyway, right? Yeah. But yeah, but that's right. This has a power that I don't think anybody ever realized, including, you know, because I know you've met him and I know him, Tony Fadell, who headed up the iPhone design team. And even though they basically did design it to be maximally addictive, I don't think even the smartest of them realized what the kind of emergent independent impact of the power of the digital devices, portable wireless devices, was going to be. And so it's definitely having effect on our attention span, on how distracted we are, on how addicted we are, because they were designed to, in some sense, be addicted. And now, of course, because of the universality of apps, you know, you can have all these apps on your phone that then, what good are they unless you use them? And then, you know, how many hours are there in the day to do all this stuff? And so I like to joke, and I'll just pick up my phone for that, you know, that maybe sooner or later I'm going to have to call myself up and check in and keep going. Are you actually present in your life? Are you paying attention to anything at all? Can you feel your body? Do you know that you're breathing? Do you know that you're healthy now and you might not be forever? Are you appreciating that? Are you appreciating your children? The moments, those precious moments where, yeah, you could be distracted by, I wonder what's on my email or my Instagram account or whatever it is. And then, of course, if I check in, hello, John, are you there? Can you feel your breathing? How is it in your body right now? Can you ride on the ways of your body? I'm going to get a bill from Verizon or AT&T, and I don't need that. All I need to do is put down the phone, and here I am already connected, if I want to be. So part of mindfulness, and the deepest part of it, is really learning how to drop in on your own being, to reconnect with who and what you already are. And it's not your phone, and it's not your thinking, and it's not your ideas of who you are, and it's not, you know, even what's going on in your body or the story of me, starring me, of course, my favorite movie, which all of us are starring in our own movie, the story of me, and everybody else is a bit player in everybody else's story. And you can really lose yourself in that for decades. And then Thoreau, as we know, was, you know, sort of preoccupied with this in the 1830s, okay, when they didn't have iPhones and they hardly had railroads, you know. They didn't even have telephones. And he described the farmers of Concord, Massachusetts, in those days, without digital technology, as leading lives of quiet desperation. And he said, I went to the woods because I wished to, in Walden, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what they had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I hadn't lived. Okay, in the 1830s in Walden. And it's like, whoa. And it was like an experiment on his part. It was a mindfulness retreat. He didn't know the word mindfulness, but he did know that there were ancient Chinese practices that, you know, were coming into, you know, some kind of contact with the West. He knew about that. Emerson knew about that. And so Walden is a kind of a rhapsody for present moment attention. He would pay attention. He'd sit in his doorway the whole day and watch the sun go across the sky and the light changing on the leaves and the reflections on the pond. And, you know, sometimes he'd stand in the pond up to his nose and just watch the insects. He was like an incredible observer of the natural world. And but it's really a meditation practice. It's an intentional cultivating of our own capacity for paying attention in a way that's open-minded and open-hearted, so that you're not trying to see what you already want to see, but you're actually being open enough, more like a scientist or like a Zen master, don't know mind. We talk about that at some point, where you just don't know, but you're willing to be present and observe, then you can learn. And out of the learning, you can grow, continue growing.
Don't know mind, is that like beginner's mind?
Well, you know, beginner's mind is a phrase that that Shunryu Suzuki used in his book, his classical book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I think the phrase is that in the expert's mind, there are a few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many. Because we, you know, once you know stuff, you're imprisoned by what you know. And then the next element of insight is harder to come by unless you can uncouple yourself from the burden of what you know. And of course, any great scientist needs that. You need to take your knowing to the absolute quintessential level. And then you have to be in, like, don't know, not knowing, until the insight that connects things that no one else has ever seen before on the planet connects them. And they say, and everybody else says, why didn't I think of that? I had all the equipment too. Well, part of it is getting out of our own way. And so my Zen teacher, my Korean Zen teacher, Sung San, was, you know, fond of talking about what he called, because he didn't speak English all that well, he called it don't know mind. Mm-hmm. Only the way he said it was don't know mind. So, but it was a really valuable lesson to actually not just be caught up in how much we know, but to actually know that we're caught up in how much we know, and also caught up in not realizing how much we don't know, or don't see, or don't hear, or don't appreciate. And then in that moment of awareness of what you're not seeing or not hearing or not knowing, you're awake. You don't have to go sit in a cave for 100 years and meditate and pretend you're Bodhidharma. You're just you. And, you know, there's something very beautiful about that, because, in fact, miraculous, because there's never been a you before in all the generations of human beings on the planet. You're the quintessence of it. I mean, you know, we each have this precious one moment we call a human life. It goes by very, very fast, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, can we embrace it fully, independent of our circumstances? So some people, like, born into poverty, poverty does not become an imprisoning force. Other people, it is. Some people born into wealth. A lot of people born into wealth. Everybody who's not born into wealth thinks it's like the greatest thing in the world, but it could also be a prison. It can imprison you in so many ways, because you have everything, maybe you don't appreciate anything because it comes too easily. And so the challenge is, can we use the opportunity of a life in the only moments we ever have, which is, of course, only one moment, it's this one now. If we can learn how to be and inhabit this moment in full awareness, which means also knowing what we don't know, or knowing that we don't know. So awareness is not just knowing, but it's knowing the knowing of not knowing. Then I know that sounds a little gobbledygookish, but actually it's tremendously catalytic of creativity and imagination, and also well-being. And we can talk about this later too, but the science is now such that we know that when you practice mindfulness as a form of formal meditation, and then bring it into your life in what we call an informal practice, It actually changes your biology. It changes all sorts of deep elements of what keeps us alive and potentially optimizes our health and well-being and our capacity to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, feel, know, the whole thing.
And it's not